The State Department could do a better job of creating new leadership and education and professional development opportunities for its career employees. In a recent report, the American Academy of Diplomacy found the department is too focused on its political appointees and politics in general, marginalizing the career employees in the Foreign Service. And our next guest, Charles Ray, says the Foreign Service itself is in need of a bit of an overhaul. Ray is a former ambassador and a member of the Foreign Service and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Prisoners of War and Missing Personnel Affairs. In a new edition of the Foreign Service Journal, he writes it's time to start thinking and treating the Foreign Service as a profession and its members as true professionals. And Ray joins us now to talk about that piece. Thank you, sir, for coming on. Appreciate having you.
My pleasure.
Let's start with that thesis, if you can. You write that we, Foreign Service officers being the we there, are not yet a profession. Why not?
Well, it's just the definition of a profession, as I outlined in the article, and I certainly hope no one takes that as an insult to the Foreign Service, because it's truly a collection of people with a lot of knowledge and expertise. It's just that the things that make a true profession are not there yet.
What are those things?
Well, a formal code of ethics. We have a ton of ethical prohibitions that are scattered throughout the regulations, but we have no easily digestible, easy to explain and understand code of ethical behavior. We have limited autonomy in what we do. As I pointed out in the article, quite often we're not told only what we are to accomplish, but quite often for domestic reasons, we're told how to go about accomplishing it. We don't have a system of career-long education. We have very good training, especially in languages and certain specific skills, but there's no system of career education that helps to develop the individual both personally and professionally to be considered a profession. I mean, I compare the Foreign Service to the military that I served in for 20 years, and military people spend a huge percentage of their time just learning new things, not just learning new skills, but thinking about why and how we do what we do. Unfortunately, in the Foreign Service, we spend so much time doing it, we get little time to reflect on why we do it and how we could do it better.
Let's stick with that education piece for a moment, because I think it's important. If what you suggest comes to pass and there is more of a career-long professional development and education process in the Foreign Service, how would the character of the Foreign Service and what it does change?
Well, I think it would. Let me go back and explain. When I joined the Foreign Service back in 1982, we were just starting to experience the shortage of experienced senior people who could serve as direct mentors and guides to people. A lot of the on-the-job training you really had to do yourself, and it's only gotten worse with time. If we had an education system that periodically allowed people to step out of the job market, as it were, and spend time basically learning not just the techniques and tactics, but the philosophy of diplomacy, I think we would have people more able to deal with a lot of the pressing problems that we face in the world today and spend a little more time building the relationships and dependencies that really makes international relations work better.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the problems you're getting at in the article is that part of this is just a numbers problem. There are not enough people in the Foreign Service that you could actually afford to have some of them go off and go to school for a while and come back and do their jobs.
It's true. I mean, there were two efforts made to create what's called a training float. That's a percentage of people over and above positions so that you wouldn't have vacant positions with people taking long-term training. In both cases, those additional positions, though they were approved by Congress, were quickly eaten up by additional job requirements levied on us. And so what you have now, I don't know the exact numbers. I've been retired since 2012, so I don't have access to accurate current numbers. But the way I understand it now, we are probably in worse shape than before in that we have more positions than we have people.
You use a phrase in the article that I've also heard a lot lately from General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is, we're not a profession just because we say we are. We have to actually do some things.
Well, I mean, you have to be recognized by those outside the profession. I mean, you can call yourself whatever you want to, but if you're not recognized by the general public, by the people that you work for, in our case, the president, the White House, the Secretary of State, as a profession, doesn't matter what you call yourself. You can be very expert, and the vast majority of Foreign Service people are extremely well educated and expert in what they do. But I spent 30 years in the business wrestling with that idea, and I had to come to the unfortunate conclusion that we're a collection of experts, but not yet a true profession.
This line of work, it seems to me, though, is going to have trouble earning a spot in the public's mind, because almost by definition, everything that you guys do is overseas and kind of out of the view of the American public, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, people think that, and to a certain extent, you're right, it is. In fact, a lot of what we do here in the U.S. is out of view of the American public. And in some ways, we're partly at fault for that, because we don't do a good enough job of educating the public about what we do. But I point this out. I did a stint as a diplomat in residence at the University of Houston back in 2005, and I spent a lot of time traveling all over South Texas, talking to schools and civic groups. And one of the things that I pointed out to them that they were a bit surprised at is any of them who had ever traveled outside the United States had come into contact with diplomacy and hadn't realized it. When you lose a passport, when you get caught up in a situation overseas, it's the consular officers of our embassies and consulates who are diplomats, who come to your rescue, who help you. If you're a company that's doing business overseas, you're involved with foreign affairs and diplomacy, often without being aware of it. But more importantly than that, if you're a shopper here in the U.S., you're running into foreign affairs and international relations every day. Just buying a pair of running shoes, the number of countries and different cultures involved in getting a pair of running shoes on the shelf of your local Foot Locker would amaze you. And as I found out talking to a group of high school students when I described the materials, the people, and the locations that are involved in getting their running shoes on the shelf, they were amazed. It had never occurred to them that this was a foreign relations issue, and that quite often diplomats play a key part in making sure that those goods are on the shelves and at prices that people can afford to pay.
That's a very good point. Last thing before I let you go, as I read your bio here, I see you had a 30-year career in the Foreign Service before eventually attaining the rank of ambassador. And I'm curious if you think that people in the Foreign Service today have that kind of opportunity to achieve that high level or make it into a senior leadership position at state.
Well, I mean, certainly they do. I mean, it's probably it's difficult. I mean, I was lucky, incredibly lucky that I got the positions that I got. But I think that those who are willing to work hard and to continue to improve their skills and their abilities have as much chance as I had of making it. I was actually a little on the old side when I joined the Foreign Service after a 20-year career in the Army. I entered as a junior officer at the age of 37, which is for a lot of career Foreign Service people, a 37-year-old junior officer in my day was pretty old. But it's really a matter of your desire to achieve and your willingness to do what's necessary to do it. And a big part of that is educating yourself. Unfortunately, there was not, and it's improving, still not where it should be, but there was not a lot of encouragement to get educated. There was encouragement to get trained, languages, certain specific skills. But getting the type of education you get, I did a year at the National War College, followed by a few years later at what we had, the senior seminar, which was a senior leadership course. And there was really no encouragement to do that. And in fact, I had to sort of push to get it because of the fear that if you stay out of the work cycle too long, you don't get job-related evaluations, it hurts your promotion and assignment chances. And that's something I think that if you had sort of an institutional attitude that learning is part of the job, that education is part of the job, that would go away, and you would just in the end have a better person out there doing the job of advancing U.S. policy aims and of helping to make the world a safer and better place.